This is Rob Gray from ASU and PerceptionAction.com. Today on the Perception in Action podcast, my interview with Mark Upton, Coaching Science Manager for the English Institute of Sport. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Perception in Action podcast, where I discuss how psychological research can be applied to improving performance, accelerating skill acquisition, and designing technologies. In today's episode, my interview with Mark Upton from the English Institute of Sport. Mark is originally from Adelaide, Australia, and received his Bachelor of Applied Science with an emphasis in human movement from the University of South Australia. He worked for 12 years in the Australian Football League as a performance analyst, coach, and coach developer. He recently joined the English Institute of Sport, where he works with coaches from a variety of different Olympic sports. I wanted to get Mark on the show for several reasons. He has approached the topic of skill acquisition from many different angles, has put a lot of the ideas of the constraints-led approach into action, and has been very engaged in trying to connect all levels of performance development. Along with these topics, we also discuss pressure on coaches, what we can learn about sports from our kids, and how to work with individuals that aren't strong believers in sports psychology. Hope you enjoy.
Not 10 years ago, I was a child. I was a good boy and you let me go. Now I'm on a talk show.
Yeah. Joining me today is Mark Upton, a coaching science manager for the English Institute of Sport, right, EIS. Thanks for taking some time to talk with me today, Mark.
Yeah, not a problem, Rob. I'm really looking forward to it.
So you are, which EIS site are you at, or do you move around between them?
Yeah, I move around a bit. I'm based at a place called Bisham Abbey, which is about 40 miles west of London.
Okay.
There's a few sports based there. The one I'm most closely linked to is field hockey. So I do a bit of stuff in a range of areas with them, but then also some other sports that mean I'm all over the place at times, yeah.
I think I've been to that one. I think we had one of our ESAN meetings at that. That's a really nice facility.
That's it. I think that was the year before I came over mm-hmm. to England. It was the ESAN was at Bisham Abbey, yeah.
Yeah, I missed those meetings. They're really anyone in the UK, you should check that out. Those are really good meetings. So you got your start, though. You're from Australia originally, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
And you got your start in Australian rules football. Mm-hmm. Which as a North American, we think looks cool, but we don't quite understand the subtle differences. So did you always have kind of goals of coaching sports science when you first started?
I played a range of ball sports growing up. Always say I was never particularly good at any of them, but was always a sporting person and probably enjoyed observing and watching sport as much as playing it. So I guess I had a bit of that analytical mind and trying to figure out what was going on, even at young ages. I can remember when I was only 12 or 13 and watching Aussie rules and sort of thinking about the tactics and space and those things, which, yeah, I don't know where that came from. But anyway, maybe that makes me a bit of a sports geek, I suppose. But so I guess that mindset maybe lent itself to, again, whether it's by design or by chance, did a sports science degree and then got an opportunity with the Adelaide Crows, one of the two professional teams in Adelaide in Australia in the AFL. Yeah, and that more from sports science into more performance analysis and then genuine coaching / skill acquisition and then sort of towards the end a little bit of coach development as well over about a 12-year period. So it was really enjoyable to do a range of roles, you know, in the one environment over a long period of time. But then it sort of got to the point where I think it felt like I needed a, you know, not a new challenge, but experience some different environments as well.
Mm-hmm. Were you, was kind of part of your motivation to get in some different sports as well?
I felt like I had a one view of the world, if you like, but obviously the world's a big place. And yeah, that was just a curiosity, I think, was to think over 10, 12 years in high performance Australian rules is what principles or things I think were, you know, made for good teams or good players and good coaching. Did that apply elsewhere? Yeah, and I think the answer in team sports is it's quite scary actually at times how similar mm-hmm. they are with a lot of things and what potentially goes into effective coaching in a team sport. But then the real eye-opener for me has been working with some individual sports. So, like, I work, do a bit of stuff with short track speed skating and sailing and some input in recently into shooting in terms of, you know, quiet iron, those sort of things. So those sports are really different, which has been enjoyable to think now, how do we do these principles still apply? How are they different? How does the culture, what's the culture like in coach-athlete relationships and those dynamics as well in individual sports, which it is different in a lot of cases.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think I said in one of our exchanges, I'm starting to try to move in the other direction a little bit, looking at, you know, going from individual sports, which I mostly focus on, to team. One of the questions I want to start looking at is how pressure, you know, on a team level, does it kind of, is it contagious? Does it move from player to player? Those kind of things. So, yeah, I think they're different problems, but they can complement each other, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, again, there's a lot of principles that still hold up that are common, but there's definitely some differences too. And particularly how athletes, so in some sports in particular, like in team sports, for example, we take it for granted that you're pretty much always have a coach. Like you're always in a team going through the age groups and the squads, you have a coach, but for a lot of individual sports, that's just not possible. Or the culture is, you know, you come up, you do it yourself. And then if you get to the high performance end, that might be, or the top end of a talent pathway, that might be more where you start having coaches involved. So it's just really interesting how different personalities and traits maybe evolve and come through because of that.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really, really interesting issue. And I know, like for myself, like when you're on a team, kind of balancing team goals versus personal goals. Like I was a ice hockey goaltender and sometimes we'd win, but I felt like I played a bad game. So I'd kind of felt bad that I wasn't satisfied. You know, you're supposed
you could be a candidate for some research. Actually, I was only speaking to an academic last week about exactly that, about different personality types and how that mediates. The team may win, but you may still be actually in quite a negative emotional state depending on your performance and those things, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. You mentioned you've kind of gone through, one of the things I think is really interesting, you've gone through this evolution or trend from being an analyst to a coach to now you kind of define your own role at EIS, right? Its own new position, kind of a coach of coaches. What's that kind of transition been like going from those different positions?
I mean, it's been good. I think it suits my mindset. I think it's stimulating doing a range of things. And so now seeing different environments and just getting a chance to view things from different perspectives. So I enjoy it. The challenge probably just personally for me now is not being embedded in one environment. Sometimes gets a little bit frustrating. You don't really feel you're a part of something that you feel when you're with a sports team over a season or multiple seasons. So the downside, if you like, or the challenge is you're sort of dropping in and out of lots of environments and working with coaches, but only, you know, in bits and bobs. So that's the challenge of how you can still, in my role at the moment, is how you can still have impact whilst you're not embedded in the environment full time.
Right. You're coming in more of a facilitator than having this direct. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. I noticed, I think I read somewhere, one of your projects on EIS at EIS is in my kind of one of my areas of interest, pressure. But looking at how coaches handle pressure as it builds up to competition. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. It was called a psychophysiological study. So basically we did things like mood profiling and questionnaires related to that, as well as sleep quality and that. But we also did some physiology stuff, so testosterone, cortisol, heart rate variability, and marrying the two together, looking at, just a small sample of coaches leading into either a world championships or a relatively important competition that their athletes are involved in. I think it just confirms it's an important area to look at, is how a coach manages themselves, and particularly in pro team sports where there's obviously huge media exposure and a lot of expectation at times, or pressure, is the coach's ability to manage themselves becoming more and more important. And maybe it's a societal trend as well, as we just keep seeming to work harder and harder and think more is more, maybe less is more sometimes. Yeah, the importance that actually high performance might actually be related to the less is more concept, but that's foreign to sporting culture.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting. And I know, like, early in athlete pressure research, we used to do these studies where you measured the buildup of anxiety up to the event. And for some reason, I think people stopped doing that. We're all just looking at the actual pressure situation. So I think that's an interesting issue still.
Yeah, because arguably, like, at the moment for Olympic sports, you know, we're about 9 months out from Rio. You know, just in conversations, you already do hear that things are changing. There's already more tension around the place. And so that pressure, if you like, is already building in a way 9 months out. And I think that's, arguably sometimes what maybe causes what we call either choking, whether it's the athlete's performance or some interesting behavior from coaching or support staff, might arguably be starting now.
Yeah. No, I could see that. Do you try to mediate that by breaking it into pieces, kind of the preparation leading up to something big like that? Or is it really hard to do? People always see the big goal, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. So what we're obviously just trying to suggest actually out of, like, say, that study is just some strategies for better managing yourself. So it's finding what works for you. And, you know, there's a range of things from just making sure you're sleeping well to going for a walk, playing a game of golf, making sure you still, you know, got social and family connections and relationships, just fairly basic fundamental things, but just trying to keep an eye on those and make sure that they're not just dropping away altogether.
Yeah. No, I was talking to someone yesterday actually about this. You know, I think that's the next, one of the next big things is what we can do with this. We can seem to be good at detecting when people get anxious and get rattled now, but what do we do about it? Wait till after the fact and tell them, or is there something we can jump in, like you're saying?
I think it's just, you know, it's the link, isn't it, with the need to monitor in some way. It doesn't always have to be intensive. It could just be you can really attune to your own state. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're not sleeping well or when you start to feel frustrated, and you know what then works for you as a strategy. So it can be quite a simple thing in the end to do in a way. It doesn't have to be costly or technology intensive even at times, but I think just an awareness of it as a starting point.
Mm-hmm. I know another thing, like, I've seen you have evolved over time is kind of your philosophies. You do a lot of reading of articles and things, and you, like, I had Keith Davids on a few weeks ago. Yep. You're a very strong believer as well in the kind of the constraints approach and the dynamical systems. Is what in particular do you like about that? What was there something in that triggered you going in that direction that you can point to?
I mean, it's a fascinating area for me theoretically to read up on. That's what I've really enjoyed just from the theory side. But I'd like to think when it comes to the applied and working with coaches and the practice side, I'm still very much on just the problem solving approach. So whilst that can inform a lot of what we do, in the end, sometimes whatever works is fine too. And that's the reality of that applied space. But I think the constraint stuff, for me, when I was still in AFL, so we, you would know, and maybe a few listeners know, Damien Farrow, who was at the Australian Institute of Sport. Mm-hmm. He worked with us for a number of years as a consultant, and one of the few, I think, skill acquisition practitioners to be working with a professional team sport. And so we learned a lot off him, and he sort of introduced us to the constraints framework. And what I liked is, without necessarily need to know all the theory behind it, such as, you know, complex systems self-organizing under constraints. We had no idea about that, but it was just a really useful tool for practice design to start thinking, right, how do we manipulate the task? Matt, how do we manipulate, you know, the individual's emotional state or the physical intensity, or even looking at, you know, in the environment, the social aspect as well, of how does the social environment influence behavior as well. So it was just a really, I think, quite a practical framework and tool that we could use that I think helped in our practice design. So I guess I've then just sort of kept exploring it and trying to understand more about its theoretical roots, as you know, from there.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the things that's nice about it, is you could kind of tackle it at different levels. You could the idea is kind of conceptually, intuitively, I think a lot of people, you can go really deep into the maths, and which gets pretty complicated pretty quickly. But so it's kind of, you can jump in at all different levels. I noticed, I think I saw something or else you have been talking about how you've also applied this at kind of the coaching and development level, not just at the individual athlete level, but in terms of the complexity idea for developing coaches as well.
We've just played around with it, but just that idea of considering the individual and then the task or a challenge or an experience in the environment, I think that could apply to any really behavior at any level or decision making and action or behavior that emerges, whether it's a coach embedded in a certain social environment, engaged in a certain task, i.e. taking a practice session, and how their individual, you know, personality or beliefs influence and all those things are interacting. So I think it's interesting to think about, can this be used in other contexts outside of just the athlete?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and skill acquisition.
So you've mentioned the social environment a few times. Is that from my impression, that seems like something EIS is really trying to foster, this interaction, this kind of common social, you know, facilitation as an organization, instead of sending off all the athletes on their own, right? Is that something they kind of really strive?
It's becoming more important in terms of how many people are involved in a high performance program these days in terms of support staff, so coaches and number of EIS practitioners. So I think this was where you were going, Rob, but that social environment of how all those relationships work is really important.
Mm-hmm.
Can obviously influence the athlete at different time scales. You know, it's not just then just about on the pitch or on the water. So it is an important aspect, I think.
Before we leave that constraints approach, you know, we were mentioning complexity a few times. And I think, like we said, it's an interesting concept because it can be understood very, very specifically. But I think some people, you know, I think people get confused between being something complicated or difficult versus complex.
Yeah.
Does that distinction, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the other person that's influenced me is a guy called Dave Snowden. So he started applying a lot of the complexity theory ideas to management, leadership, culture. And he's got this Canevin framework, and that distinguishes between something that's complicated versus complex. And there is an important difference in that complicated, like they talk about building a rocket to go to the moon, is a complicated endeavor, but it's not complex, as in with enough analysis and expertise, we can pretty much get to a blueprint to design something that will make it to the moon, hopefully 99.9% of the time, for example. And so we can get to a high degree of certainty with enough analysis and expertise. But in complexity, the analogy it's normally used is raising children, for example. Children are alike, which immediately just says, well, anytime almost you're dealing with people. So whether it's a long-term athlete development or person development or a big social group of people with a lot of interactions, it's complex. There's a lot of interactions and there's a lot of uncertainty about what might emerge over different timescales. And so how you manage or proceed, you can't really forecast too far ahead. So the idea is how you manage complexity is almost by staying in the moment, if you like, and being attuned to emergent opportunities or the way the system's starting to unfold, and sort of pursue the direction it takes you, almost, rather than trying to predefine here's exactly where we want to get to and here's exactly the steps we're going to take, because it just, there's not that level of uncertainty. So complexity is really interesting, I think, from a coaching point of view. Like that's coaching a lot of the time. It's grey, it's uncertain. You sort of take one step at a time, but also at a management level as well, it's quite interesting too. So, you know, moving away from the traditional project management approaches of just milestones that we have to hit and all these sort of these things may not be appropriate in complex situations.
I really like that idea too. I find in my own job, academia, if I just stuck to the goals, I would miss so many things. So many random things come up that you never know where they're going to go. And I think if I just focused on these targets, I would miss so many things. But
that's it. And there's this other concept that's often linked with complexity called obliquity, which is you aim over here, but then you end up achieving something as a spin-off, if you like, that you never could have achieved if you were driving hard for that thing. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. So sometimes I think a guy called John Kay's written a book sometimes how your goals are best achieved indirectly, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the moment, the contentious stuff, particularly over here, I think with talent development and football academies and, you know, the commodity that young people are becoming, it's hard to get their head around that maybe if we just focused on helping these young kids be as good a people as they can be, that enough of them will end up being pretty handy football players anyway.
Yeah.
But whilst we focus so narrowly on trying to make expert football players, maybe we're missing the key ingredient, but it's hard for people to get their head around that.
Yeah, no, definitely. I could see that. You mentioned kids a couple of times. One of the things I really enjoyed reading on your blog is you've talked about how you've kind of learned a lot from your son. That's something I can relate to too. I'm hoping to get more into that on the podcast eventually, but can you talk a little bit about that, kind of those experiences?
Yeah, it's been really good. I think probably, again, coming back into my predisposition to observe closely, I'd hate to say I use my son as a experiment because I don't interfere, but I certainly observe closely, you know, his development and what engages him and all those things. And I think with younger kids, some of these theoretical ideas around skill development and learning are a lot clearer to see at times because they are in the earlier stages. You do see the progression or the change or the difference more clearly than later on in athlete development or in people development. So, yeah, some of the theory, I guess, is lining up for me, particularly the dynamical system stuff. I think, you know, like some like Esther Thielen's work, you know, that just, yeah, it just resonates that we tend to think as maybe people mature that and cognitively are more developed that the way we learn changes completely, but I'm sure it does a bit, but maybe those principles are still there. That's what's interesting.
Yeah, no, I think I've had the same experience, like concepts like self-organization when you watch kids just, you know, naturally just make their own games and their own, yeah. Find their own. It really, you see it in action, definitely.
Yeah. And I mean, even being on Twitter a bit earlier today, the debate is still raging as well about things like the game as the teacher or just free and informal play versus coach directed and instructed environments. And there's no single answer to that. But I think before you get into that, maybe what's best for skill acquisition, I think the first thing is engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So the most important thing is what engages a young person in an activity, because I'm saying to lean towards it, that you could design the best practice environment or learning environment from, a, you know, all the Skill Act principles, but if they're not engaged, you just, I think the learnings or the learning rate is going to be limited or mm-hmm. slow. So I think it's missing the trick a little bit. It's, for me, the first question is what's going to engage this young person, because if they're engaged, I think you'll see learning happen relatively rapidly, maybe regardless too much of the actual practice design then.
No, I totally agree. And one of the challenges I've had a little bit is being involved with some teams and things is trying to know when to jump in and speak my point. You know, some coaches are very, you know, they have their plans and things, and if you disagree, it's a tough position to the old adage of making them think they came up with the idea themselves.
Yeah,
it really does work in a lot of cases.
But, okay, I was going to say, what have you figured out, Robert?
That's the only thing that just kind of talking around things and hoping that you don't realize that you're trying to plant an idea in their head. But it's still probably. I've had one situation where you just had to leave basically because you know there's no. And I found that generally just working with coaches with research, there's some that want to be, they have their, you know, athletes involved with the stuff we do. Some of them are just very open and some are really closed and you're not going to change their mind.
How do those engagements start for you, Rob? Like, had that relationship of you coming in, because I've got some thoughts on that, but how did that unfold for you?
With it's really just personal. It's always been like personal level, you know, through another contact or just meeting someone at an event and just chatting with them. I've got to, and once I found, you know, once those personal things have opened up, I've had one coach send his whole team up basically within a 2-day period. And you could tell he told them how important this was to him, and they were all really engaged, and it was amazing. Got all our data basically in a week. It was incredible. So that's all I found. I haven't really had, I don't know if I have a secret other than getting that personal connection first. So they know kind of you're not just a name on a paper and stuff.
Yeah.
But what about your experience? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it can quickly get frustrating if the relationship isn't right. If, like you said, if the coaches aren't open-minded, so, you know, if the engagement with them hasn't stemmed from their curiosity, then I'm now quite wary, because mm-hmm. I've learned from, you go in and you might initially present some of the concepts and principles in a workshop type thing, and you get the nods and whatever, but you just know that they're not, you know, they're ticking a box, if you like, because someone's told them they should listen to this stuff. But it's the ones that are really curious, you can sort of tell early on and open. And they're good fun to engage in. And then sometimes the struggle becomes, though, is that they now think that science has the answers for them. Mm-hmm. So when we run through the constraints framework, you can see them start to think, yeah, but that doesn't tell me exactly what I should do, like what percentage of games or drills should I do and what order should they be in these things. And I say, no, if anything, it increases the demands on observation and decision-making of the coach, actually, to do this well. And so sometimes then you sort of get a bit of I thought you'd come in and have the answers for me, the magic recipe. So it's interesting working through those dynamics.
Yeah, I've exactly the same kind of experience. And partially because a lot of the coaches I work with, if they have some performance scientist, it's a physiology person.
Yeah.
So they think I'm going to tell them what the optimal and in psychology, we can't do that. We don't. It's an uncertain science. You know, it's probabilistic. Yeah. I found the same thing. And I think when I was talking with Keith, I found it's helped when, you know, just talking with coaches and you realize they have the same ideas. We just use different words. It's just, when you can make that connection. I had a baseball coach. He had really, the things he was telling his players, I was like, that's exactly, he was really excited to see this connection.
Exactly. And that, you know, and I think that's a good way to approach it too, is to sort of just say it's probably what a lot of good coaches have already done for a period of time, you know, with that tacit, intuitive, experiential knowledge, which I think can help to influence others sometimes when you do make that connection with, of course, the coaches are already doing this. That, again, has social influence on others. So I try to, normally pull out some examples. You know, there's some nice quotes from Phil Jackson about, you know, the way he coached, and he's got a beautiful quote about, he said, needing the players to disconnect from me so that they can connect with their teammates in the game. Mm-hmm. So it's this argument about, well, they don't need to be perceptually attuned to me, they need to be perceptually attuned to the movement of all teammates, opponents. So that's what leads to good decisions and good performance. So, yeah, I think that's a fruitful avenue, is to find some nice practical case studies or just quotes sometimes that bring it to life.
Yeah, no, I agree. And when you can connect it to someone really successful, a lot of people help you.
Championships behind it either.
Yeah, no, I know I used to, when I watch basketball, you'd see him at times when a normal coach would call a timeout because the team was struggling. He would just stand there with his arms folded and you figure it out. So,
You mentioned that in that same piece, actually, I was referring to. He said exactly that about just letting the players have to figure it out themselves, and, you know, they might get themselves in a bit of trouble early on, but they'll eventually develop that skill, if you like, of working it out themselves.
Another thing that, you know, I think has been really interesting, you have been, you know, very active on social media, online, with kind of coaching. I think we first met on Twitter, probably.
And
now one of your My Fastest Mile kind of endeavor, where you're doing kind of group hangouts and blogs and a bunch of different things. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so My Fastest Mile, I've partnered with, or was founded by, a guy called Al Smith, who was head of talent science and pathway at the EIS, which is how I met him initially, but he left soon after I arrived. And he started up My Fastest Mile, and a range of things. I think a lot of it comes down to learning. So we're interested in what are the best learning environments for athletes, players, but also coaches, potentially managers, leaders. Yeah, it doesn't really matter. But I think we're passionate as much about grassroots and the community aspect, and try and actually connect that with the high performance, and whereas at the moment it feels like there's a bit of a gap emerging between those things. A lot of money goes into high performance, and for legitimate reasons as well. So with, you know, a range of things from hangouts to where we're doing these relearn events, which we've done one so far where we got a real eclectic mix of people from grassroots, an under 10s coach to a PE teacher to the performance director of one of the Olympic programs. So we got a really great mix of people just to discuss, well, similar to what we've touched on today about learning and development and environments that, you know, are helping our tagline is helping people be their best, that, you know, helps them to fulfill their potential.
Yeah. And I think another thing you've stressed by the very title of your right your site is this kind of, it's a continual process, right? There's always room for learning and improvement. And
yeah,
you can always run your fastest mile, I think.
So. Exactly. That's our story. He's ours in his early 40s, but it's occurred to him that maybe he's still got his fastest mile in him that he's not done with yet, because he was a runner, or is a runner. I shouldn't say was, he won't like that. but that resonated with me and, yeah, and our philosophy that it's continual learning. And I think that's something I took out of AFL and even – so one of the AFL teams, I caught up with someone from Hawthorn this week, actually, was over in London, but they've won the last three championships in the AFL, three in a row. And so sustainable success, like how do you develop that? And for me, it is through continual learning and adapting and innovating. It's when you think you've got it figured out, and so many do, that's why we rarely actually see sustainable success, because it's not achieved by doing things the same. It's achieved actually by adapting, learning, and doing things differently when needed.
Yeah. No, I agree, especially in sports. I think even if your approach and method's really good, it just gets – people don't listen to it anymore after a while. I think you either see two kinds of coaches, ones that evolve or ones that just move around a lot. So they can keep giving it to a new group. But,
It is, Rob, one of those real, like a real delicate balance between clearly things have worked. You don't want to throw it all out. Like things have obviously worked and been pillars of why you've maybe had some initial success. So it is, I think, very contextual, and you need to think long and hard about what do we need to do differently, but equally what is going to still need to be in place. You know, that is one of those things that I think can cause sleepless nights.
Yeah, definitely. What's next, you know? Back to your role at EIS, you're developing coaches as it actually approaches the big event in Rio. Mm. How's your role going to change, or what will your role in the actual event itself?
Yeah, well, at this stage, I won't have anything. Hopefully the important work's mm-hmm. done, or any input that I can have, the significant input will be done before that. So, yeah, my role's interesting in a way, almost looking to the next cycle. So because mm-hmm. my role was new and it came in halfway through this cycle, we've done a few things and in Skillac and some coach development stuff, but actually it's all, in a lot of ways, I've almost got my eye on the next cycle and how we might do things differently there. So, yeah, I think in the Olympic system there's, rightly or wrongly, they tend to want to lock down fairly early to say, okay, we're now preparing, things are in place, we don't want to try anything new. Yeah, that's a bit of the culture of the Olympic system, which I find interesting coming from a team sport, where if you said to me, well, we're 9 months out from our grand final, we'd be like, well, we've got plenty of time to keep innovating, trying things, and maybe, you know, halfway through the season, if we're going well, we'll then try and sort of bed things down in terms of processes and how we go about it. But I think it's just from a 4-year cycle, I guess, when you're 9 months away, it seems close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Yeah. Do you have, I know this is kind of a, I think a challenging thing in skill acquisition is how do you actually evaluate what you're doing other than the medals, right?
Yeah.
Is there any way that you can in this period see?
Yeah. It's a really interesting one for a lot of reasons for how, yeah, you get measured yourself as well, and people's tendency to want to try to quantify everything too. So I think it's actually one of the reasons why Skillac, you know, is similar to psychology, sometimes hasn't grown as quick as the other sports sciences, because it deals with that uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And so part of that is, well, how do you measure impact? For example, that, you know, I've supported a coach for say 2 or 3 months on practice design, like how do we measure the impact of that, and particularly in team sports? So it is difficult to do. Personally, what I'm looking for is, for my own benefit, is qualitative feedback from whoever I've worked with, whether it's coaches or athletes, to say, yeah, we think this has been helpful. We may not have seen results yet, but we think it's a fruitful approach, or it's worth pursuing, and you know, either with or without me after that. So I think it's more qualitative that I'm looking from coaches and athletes as much as anything. Yeah, but certain skills in certain sports will lend themselves to quantifying, won't they? As you know, Rob, with some of your work, it's not to rule that out completely.
No, I agree. And especially since you're, you know, working with different environments, different athletes, general metrics aren't, you know, it's really going to be hard to come up with that.
Yeah.
So, no, I think that's really interesting. Thing. So one of the things I've been kind of stressing through the podcast is this kind of connection between practice and science, and trying to build it a bit stronger. And, you know, a lot of people you hear don't get much, you know, can't see the relevance or thing. How has that been for you?
In which aspect, the relevance of?
Of the science, you know, the journal articles and trying to translate it and things like that.
Yeah, I think for me, definitely. So I'm obviously not, like I said earlier, I'm not coaching at the moment, or I'm not embedded in one program. But I think if I was to go back into that environment, having a more depth of theoretical knowledge will definitely help me than where I was at 5 years ago. Obviously, the experiential knowledge and the hands-on is really important too. But personally, for me, I find it rewarding digging deeper into the theory and the science, but it's a bit of a diminishing returns as well on the practical end. So you start digging deeper and there's not as much return, I think, as just early on. So, you know, for just coaches, it's what are those high level principles, that even things like evidence-based is a really interesting concept as well. Like, what is really evidence? And evidence in one context may not be with another, and we're back into this complexity idea of everything's different all the time and constantly changing. So, I think for me, it's, you know, having a depth of the theory is good, because I think it does add more tools to your toolkit, if you like, or potentially have some places to start with in a variety of problems and challenges that come up in athlete development. Say, okay, I've seen, you know, I understand some of the theory here might be the starting point, but that's no guarantee that that's going to solve the problem by treating it that way. So it's still very much problem solving for me, and being able to work your way through, you know, a skill development challenge, and that's the same whether it's, you know, more a psychological challenge as well, of working with a difficult athlete. You know, how does a coach find the way to connect with maybe a challenging personality or a difficult athlete and get the best out of them and integrate them into the team? You know, there's no answers out of a textbook for that. There can be some little clues maybe of where to start, but then you're into just trying something, see if how it works, and iterating sort of off of that. So
how much of it is kind of doing task analysis, investigating, trying to understand what the issue, the problem is? You know.
Yeah, exactly. That idea of tidying up the problem, I think, and really defining at the start is a key thing. So again, whether that's qualitatively by just really observing well, or in some situations having good conversations and communication with a range of people that give you a good perspective on the problem or the challenge or a specific athlete. Other times you can take a more quantitative approach with a task analysis, for example. Like, I think that's where performance analysis is still underutilized, to really use it more in a task analysis fashion, to say, you know, if a player on a pitch, you know, what are the perceptual demands? What, you know, what are positioning of defenders? How much time and space do they have? You know, the scenarios, you know, what are the real specific scenarios they face? What direction are they facing? And what's the range of situations they'll find themselves in? So I think some skills, if you like, if you try and develop, do lend themselves to some quantitative task analysis too.
Yeah, I think you're right. It has to be a good mix. Okay, Mark. So I appreciate the time. I always enjoy chatting with you and interacting on Twitter and everything. So thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Yeah, no worries, Rob. I'm just trying to think if I've got any questions for you. where do you see this going? I'm interested in, obviously, you're most prolific in pushing out some of these podcasts. So what's your why, and where are you hoping to take it?
Yeah, it's kind of gotten out of control. I started with the goal, I'll do it every 2 weeks, then week, and then I got restless. So part of it's using it for teaching. So I'm preparing like for online materials. So
yep.
I'm doing those and those, doing those. And then, and you know, just going to see where it goes, you know, trying to get a, you know, do some interviews and I'm getting, you know, getting feedback that people seem to like it. So
yeah, absolutely. I think even like on Twitter, I know a couple of people who are probably more coaches or don't have a strong science background have really enjoyed them. So I think you're filling that gap quite nicely.
No, thank you. Yeah. No, and I enjoy, you know, the getting the stuff out there and trying to talk to people about it. It's just, you don't get that when you just publish and
wait
for someone, you know.
Yeah, it's a cat talking.
Yeah, you don't really get that immediate direct feedback in academia like this. So it's kind of rewarding.
And I can't believe we almost got through and we didn't talk about flashing lights or things like that. As being improving decision making.
Yeah.
But you filled a really good void is actually just clarifying all the cognitive brain training and
what's
worth looking at and what's probably not worth looking at, I think is, it's out of control in a way, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It's there's so many of them. I don't know how many more are coming out, but.
And that is, I think, drawing back to the need to understand some of the theory, isn't it, around, you know, whether it is the ecological psychology and you know, if you are trying to train perceptual skill, well, what are you trying to develop?
Exactly. Yeah, that's something that, you know, I think I've talked about from, you know, keeping perception and action together. You have to understand them together is kind of the biggest message I took from Gibson when I first started and.
Yeah,
kind of what I, you know, wanted to always do. So yeah, I think you're right. This general belief that everything applies will transfer to everything else. I kind of think we need to break that down. You know, maybe some things will, but there's so much needs to be demonstrated before we jump on these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Mark.
No worries. Pleasure.
Thanks again for the great chat, Mark. I really enjoyed hearing about your journey in skill acquisition, and I agree that the learning never ends. I would highly recommend listeners follow Mark on Twitter at UPPY01 and check out myfastestmile.com, as he is highly engaged and shares a lot of great insights. Coming soon on the Perception in Action podcast, Consolidation and Interference in Motor Learning. This is Rob Gray from ASU. Cheers for now. We'll cut you quick.